KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Happy New Year! Galveston 89.5 HD2 and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. KPFT is Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. From The Guardian, I think that our first story qualifies as something to keep an eye on, but not to get alarmed about yet. Bird flu virus shows mutations in first severe human infection in U.S., CDC says. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on Thursday its analysis of samples from the first severe case of bird flu in the country last week showed mutations not seen in samples from an infected backyard flock on the patient's property. The CDC said the patient's sample showed mutations in the hemagglutinin 8 or HA gene, the part of the virus that plays a key role in it attaching to host cells. The agency said the risk to the general public from the outbreak has not changed and remains low. Last week, the United States reported its first severe case of the virus in a Louisiana resident above the age of 65 who was suffering from severe respiratory illness. The patient had been infected with the D1.1 genotype of the virus that had been recently detected in wild birds and poultry in the U.S. and not the B3.13 genotype detected in dairy, cows, humans, and some poultry in multiple states. The mutations seen in the patient are rare, but have been reported in some cases in other countries and most often during severe infections. One of the mutations was also seen in another severe case in British Columbia, Canada. No transmission from the patient in Louisiana to other persons has been identified, said the CDC. So, we'll just have to see how this progresses. From CNBC.com, as older Americans downsize, over 20 million homes could become available, but they're not where young people want to move. As the U.S. continues to face a shortage of available homes, some may be looking at those occupied by empty nesters as an incoming source of inventory. As older residents begin to downsize, the thinking goes, the millions of homes they currently own will fill the deficit, thus bringing housing costs down. However, those units aren't likely to be a solution, Orf Devungai, a senior economist at Zillow, tells CNBC Make It. The reason is simple. Empty nesters, which Zillow defines as residents ages 55 or older who have lived in the same home for 10 or more years, have no children at home, and have at least two extra bedrooms, don't live in the same places where younger generations want to be, recent research finds. Devungai said in the report, quote, these empty nest households are concentrated in more affordable markets where housing is already more accessible, not in the expensive coastal job centers where young workers are moving and where more homes are most desperately needed, unquote. Around 20.9 million households fit the definition of empty nesters in 2022, and out of the 50 biggest U.S. cities, they have the greatest concentrations in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, New York, and Cleveland, Ohio. But the cities with the most under 44 are San Jose, California, Austin, Texas, and Denver, Colorado, Zillow reports. Devungai says, quote, unless we see more businesses and workers relocating to the Midwest, the big flow of housing coming is probably not going to do much to help those markets, unquote. Of course, the homes empty nesters are vacating might not be the same properties young people are looking for, especially if they are large or relatively expensive for the area. So what will actually move the needle? The only viable solution for improving housing affordability is new construction in the cities facing the largest shortages, Devungai says. However, there are a number of roadblocks preventing construction from keeping up with demand. including the rising costs of building materials, lot size requirements, density restrictions, and project reviews that can take up to 24 months. Devungai says, quote, when you prevent supply from keeping up with demand, you end up with runaway prices and affordability deteriorates, unquote. Lowering costs for builders will be key to making progress in this area, Devungai says. Changes to zoning laws and streamlining building permit approvals may also help push things in the right direction. He added, quote, if you look at places that are less regulated, like in the South, builders have been able to lean into density in order to continue building houses at a price point that meets buyers where they're at, unquote. So I have several takeaways from this story. It would be helpful to create jobs in markets where there is or will be plenty of housing. In some places, like Detroit, much of the housing will be in serious need of rehab, but that isn't necessarily a deal breaker. Helping to create jobs where housing is already in adequate supply would probably benefit from some form of federal assistance or incentives. Changing zoning laws, etc., could be of help in some areas, but land is a finite resource, and in some cases, using that land at a higher density will require demolishing what already exists. Higher density housing can be defined in several ways. More and bigger apartment complexes, attached townhomes, individual homes with smaller land footprints, etc. But when you take a developed area and redevelop it for more congestion, it has a knock-on effect on expensive infrastructure. You would now need more capacity in water and sewage supply, electricity, roads, parking, transit, and more. Also, by its very nature, new housing stocks will be more expensive for consumers to buy or rent than older housing stocks. That raises the question of how much new construction can really make a dent in affordability, since no one will build new housing that loses money unless you're talking about government housing subsidies to build and or rent. And the final complication, as the story discusses, is that any newly available housing has to be of a kind and in places that people want, which brings us back to the beginning. Maybe look at it this way. There are places that will be dealing with what amounts to a baby boom and other places where they'll be dealing with what amounts to a baby bust. So maybe looking at how states, cities, and communities dealt with those problems in years past might offer some guidance with how different places can manage their housing and infrastructure problems moving forward. The link I'm providing to the following story on my website is gifted, so if you go to thinkwingradio.com and click on the article link, there will be no paywall. This is a long but critically important story about national defense and the struggles that the U.S. is having not only meeting the essential demands of Ukraine, potential demands of our own military. At a time when the world is at least as dangerous as it was in the mid-1930s, our ability to quickly mobilize our industrial base for a major war has never been so limited. Pointing fingers and laying blame is not an option. The only thing we can do now is make a serious, sustained, and accelerated, and predictably expensive effort to course correct for our security and the security of our critical alliances. This story is called The Crumbling Foundation of America's Military. It's from theatlantic.com. Here, in the third decade of the 21st century, the most sought-after ammunition in the U.S. arsenal reaches the vital stage of its manufacture, where tan flakes of trinitrotoluene, better known as the explosive TNT, are stirred slowly into a brown slurry. The brown slurry must be the right thickness before it oozes down metal tubes to the ground floor and into waiting rows of empty 155mm howitzer shells, each filled at the top with a funnel. The whole production line is labor-intensive, messy, and dangerous. At this step of the process, both the steel shells and the TNT must be kept warm. The temperature in the building induces a full-body sweat in a matter of minutes. This is essentially the way artillery rounds were made a century ago. Each shell is about 2 feet high and 6 inches wide and will weigh 100 pounds when filled with the explosive. At the far end of the production line, after the shells are filled and fitted with a fuse, the rounds are loaded on rail cars for the first step in their journey to war. Each train carries such a large concentration of TNT that there's a solid concrete barrier 20 feet high and 20 feet thick between the rails and the building. The Metal Pour building is the tallest structure on the grounds of the Iowa Army Ammunition Plant, which sits on 30 square miles of prairie, forest, and brush in the southeastern corner of the state, not far from the Mississippi River. Built in 1940, it's a relic. It's also currently the only place in America for high-volume production of 155mm artillery shells, the key step of which is known as LAP, for loading, assembling, packing, turns empty shells into live ordnance. The building looks perfectly mundane, like many old factories in rural towns. There's only one clue to what's going on inside. Giant chutes, like water slides, slope down on the ground from the upper floor. These are for escape, although no one doubts that anyone could clear the blast radius of a building where TNT is stored in tons. There hasn't been a serious accident at the Iowa plant in years, but 70 names are inscribed on a memorial at the entrance for men and women killed on the job, most of them by explosions. The Iowa production line is at once essential and an exemplar of industrial atrophy. It illustrates why the richest military on earth could not keep up with the demand for artillery ammunition after Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. At that time, the U.S. was manufacturing about 14,000 shells a month. By 2023, the Ukrainians were firing as many as 8,000 shells per day. It has taken 2 years and billions of dollars for the U.S. to ramp up production to 40,000 shells a month, well short of Ukraine's needs. A big part of the reason is that we still make howitzer rounds the way our great-grandparents did. There are better, faster, safer ways. You can watch videos online of automated plants, for example, operating in Europe. Some new American facilities are starting up, but they are not yet at capacity. The problem isn't just howitzer shells, and it isn't only that the U.S. can't build drones, rockets, and missiles fast enough to meet the needs of Ukraine. America itself lacks stockpiles of the necessary components. A massive rebuilding effort is now underway, the largest in almost a century, but it will not, cannot happen fast enough, and even the expanded capacity would not come close to meeting requests the size of Ukraine's, much less restore our own depleted reserves. Take drones, for instance. In December 2023, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky called for the domestic production of 1 million annually to meet war needs, and Ukraine has met that goal. In the meantime, the supply of drones provided by the U.S. to Ukraine has numbered in the thousands, and many of those have not fared as well on the battlefield as Ukraine's homemade, often jerry-rigged models, and off-the-shelf Chinese drones. Other allies have stepped up with material of many kinds, artillery, armored vehicles, aircraft, but fighters in Ukraine are still coping with disabling shortages. At stake here is more than the fate of Ukraine. As a new administration prepares to take power, led by a man, Donald Trump, who has been hostile to Zelensky and his country's cause, and who admires Russia and Vladimir Putin, the future of American aid to Ukraine is at best uncertain. It could very well diminish or even come to an end, but the obstacles the U.S. has faced in trying to supply Ukraine during the past 2 years have revealed a systemic, gaping national security weakness. It is a weakness that afflicts the U.S. military at all levels and about which the public is largely unaware. The vaunted American war machine is in disarray and disrepair. Shocking is not overstating the condition of some of our facilities, said Representative Donald Norcross, chairing a House Armed Services subcommittee hearing on munitions manufacturer a month after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Ted Anderson, a retired Army officer who is now a principal partner of Forward Global, a defense consultancy, said, quote, "You would stay awake all night if you had any idea how short we are of artillery ammo," unquote. In 2023, the U.S. Army Science Board expressed concern that the nation's industrial base, quote, "may be incapable of meeting the munitions demand created by a potential future fight against a peer adversary," unquote. Mackenzie Eaglin, a defense analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, and one of the authors of the Science Board's report, immersed herself in this world of procurement and manufacturing for nearly a year. Quote, "When I was done," she said, "the only thing I could think was, it's a miracle the U.S. military has anything that blows up, ever. So what happened?" Well, I'll continue reading after this quick break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Thursdays at 6 p.m., Sundays at 1 p.m., and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Shows and articles go back to May 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are at least 90% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and look for me on Threads, Blue Sky, and a teensy weensy bit on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. The problems mentioned thus far are not just a bump in the road, and it is not just about munitions. The U.S. military, the richest in the world, confronts a deep institutional deficiency. If that truth is hard to accept, it's partly because the reality is so profoundly at odds with our history. In December 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt called on America to become the arsenal of democracy. He had the foresight to gear up the arms industry almost a year before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The war machine then performed astonishing feats. The Navy outbuilt every other country in the world combined, launching more than 1,000 new warships along with fleets of cargo vessels, troop carriers, and tankers. Production of aircraft was even more astonishing. In all the years prior to 1939, only about 6,000 aircraft had been manufactured in America. Over the next 5 years, American factories rolled out 300,000. They also built 86,000 tanks and more than 2 million trucks. Production of ammunition accelerated so fast that by 1943 there were 2.5 billion rounds on hand, and the volume was creating storage problems. American arms won the war. That mighty manufactory was scaled back markedly when the war ended, then geared up once more during the Korean conflict and the Cold War. By 1961, it was again such a colossus that President Dwight Eisenhower warned about the growing influence of the military-industrial complex. This is how many of us think of it still: menacingly big, cutting-edge, professional, vigilant, lethal, and outrageously expensive. The Pentagon's nearly $1 trillion annual budget is more than the defense spending of the next 9 biggest militaries combined. It is a preposterous sum that pays for an industrial infrastructure that includes mining operations, chemical plants, factories, storage depots, arsenals, ships, trains, aircraft, launching pads, and research labs. It is less an industry than an ecosystem. Today it is global, and so complex and mutable that it has become nearly impossible to map. Leaving aside an enormous privatized service sector that supports government operations, the military's industrial infrastructure has 3 overlapping parts. The first and oldest is the military's own organic industrial base: factories, depots, and arsenals scattered all over America. Some of these, particularly those considered most vital or secret, are owned and operated by the government itself. Most, like the Iowa plant, are so-called GOCOs, government-owned, contract-operated. This organic industrial base supplies the basics: ammo, vehicles, and equipment. The second part of the industrial war machine is the corporate manufacturing sector, dominated today by the Big 5 contractors: Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Raytheon. These companies enjoy profitable deals to develop and build sophisticated weapons systems. The third and newest part of the war machine is the tech sector, including Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Palantir, SpaceX, and Anduril, and a large number of smaller firms. These are responsible for the software and hardware that have become a crucial element of modern war. Drones and associated technology, as well as AI and systems for electronic surveillance, communications, data analysis, and guidance. The rapid evolution of drones in the Russia-Ukraine war, where automated attack and defense strategies change almost daily, illustrates how vital the tech sector has become. Together, these sectors support what remains the most potent fighting force on the planet, but the foundation is crumbling. Much has been written about the Pentagon's devotion to big, expensive, and arguably outdated weapons platforms such as fighter jets, bombers, guided missiles, and aircraft carriers. Little notice has been paid to the deterioration of its industrial base, which underpins everything. There are plenty of reasons for what has happened. Strategic planning failed to foresee a sudden demand for conventional arms. The post-Cold War peace dividend put most military contractors out of business. Budget wars in Congress have created funding uncertainty that dissuades long-term investment in arms manufacture. As for munitions, much of the dirty and dangerous work of making them has been outsourced overseas to countries where labor is cheap and regulations, such as environmental and safety, are few. Meanwhile, in every kind of military manufacture, from the most to the least sophisticated, we depend for raw materials and components such as uranium, chemicals, explosives, computer chips, spare parts, and expertise on an expansive global supply chain, in some cases involving the very countries such as China and Russia that we are most likely to fight. In a case study, take the howitzer round, a relatively simple munition which illustrates the problems we face. The howitzer itself is a centuries-old weapon, a mobile firing tube bigger than a mortar and smaller than a cannon. It's often mounted on wheels and is usually used in groups. It's convenient for throwing substantial shells over an army's own forces and into the ranks of a nearby enemy. A 155mm howitzer shell has a blast radius of more than 150 feet, sends fragments even farther, and can damage or destroy vehicles and fortified positions. Today's howitzer round has a variety of parts, each requiring its own production process. The steel casing is made with a specially formulated alloy called HF1, the initials stand for high fragmentation, that's designed to withstand the tremendous pressure of being shot out of a cannon, but also frangible enough to shatter into shards when it explodes at the target. Most of this kind of steel is imported from Japan and Germany, but some of it also comes from China. Into each steel casing is poured explosive material, what the military calls energetics, that today is generally TNT, 24 pounds of it per round. Currently, no TNT is manufactured in the U.S. Nearly all of what we use is imported from Poland and is made with chemical precursors from other countries, including, again, China. To increase U.S. production tenfold would require 2.4 million pounds of TNT monthly, which is why the military is shifting to a newer explosive, IMX, that will ultimately replace TNT entirely, but not anytime soon. The U.S. already has stockpiles of this material, and more of it is being made. The Army has nearly tripled its IMX order from the Holston Army Ammunition Plant in Tennessee. Then there's the need for copper, a band of which is wrapped around the base of each shell to seal it tightly inside the firing chamber. This enables the shell to spin out of the rifled tube, improving its accuracy. To propel the round, there's another energetic at its base, nitrocellulose, which is manufactured at the Radford Army Ammunition Plant in Virginia. Its chemical ingredients are imported from all over the world. To ignite the propellant, each round has a primer, essentially a small brass cup and a copper pin with its own small amount of explosive powder. At the tip of the round is the fuse, spelled with a Z, which contains a battery that is activated when the round begins spinning. The small mechanical and electronic components of the fuse determine when and where the round explodes, whether on impact or in the air above the target. Each of these components must be mass-produced, and each has its own complex manufacturing story. Making energetics in particular is expensive, difficult, and traditionally a major source of pollution. In the U.S., old Army ammunition plants figure prominently in the more than 600 military facilities the EPA has designated as Superfund sites, priority cleanup areas. Today, the Iowa plant is clean enough that the land around it is used for recreational hunting and fishing and is considered a haven for some endangered species. But in years past, after the plant was steam cleaned to prevent the buildup of explosive dust and residue, the streams in nearby Burlington ran pink, which is the color TNT turns when exposed to sunlight. The plant is still regularly steam cleaned, but with strict and expensive runoff controls. The cost of environmental stewardship is steep. So, on top of other obstacles that stand in the way of a rapid surge in production, not just of howitzer shells, but of any military ordnance and equipment, you can add the legitimate demands of good government. Environmental regulations, safety regulations, and all the built-in safeguards against waste and fraud. One more thing. Workers capable of handling jobs at the military's industrial plants don't just walk in off the street. The Science Board report noted, quote, "Generally, it takes 2 years for an average line worker in munitions to be effective. For energetics, that timeline is extended to 7 years." Unquote. Ramping up existing plants like the one in Scranton that forges the steel casings for howitzer shells is done by doubling and then tripling the number of 8-hour work shifts. This has been accomplished in the 2 years since the invasion of Ukraine. Generous overtime benefits and new hires keep plants running around the clock, but the facilities themselves are antiques. A small fire broke out at the Scranton Army Ammunition Plant in September, forcing the evacuation of the affected building. No one was injured, but the incident raised concerns about vulnerability. Portions of the plant date back to the 19th century. Originally built to maintain rails and rail cars, it became a giant steel foundry during the Korean War. Today, many of its union workers are long-tenured and are second- and third-generation employees. The painstaking process, which the article described, is eliminated in newer plants in other countries where TNT is inserted with a more efficient method called a screw extrusion, one very thin layer at a time. The process virtually eliminates imperfections. It is not new. The modern form of the process was developed in the 1960s and is yet another example of how static U.S. production methods have remained. The Army opened part of its first automated shell production facility in Mesquite, Texas early this year, and a new loading, assembling, and packing plant is under construction in Camden, Arkansas. Crucial expansion of energetics production is underway at Holston and of propellant production at Radford. Most of these projects are years from being completed. They will require skilled workers and customized new equipment, and once they are all fully operational, which could take years, they will need a lot of energetics. For that, in September 2023, the Army signed $1.5 billion in new contracts. Some of the contracts have gone to companies in the U.S., but others have gone to firms in Canada, India, and Poland. The Pentagon hopes that this expansion will bring production of 155mm howitzer shells to 100,000 rounds a month by 2026, up from the current level of 40,000 a month. NATO countries are also expanding production. All of this will help, but it will also increase competition for scarce minerals and explosives. Poland, for instance, has its own 144-mile border with Russia and is engaged in its own military buildup. It may be one of the world's largest manufacturers of TNT, but it isn't going to sell all of it. Ukraine is also desperately in need of missiles such as Javelins and Stingers, anti-missile systems, and rocket launching platforms such as the High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, better known by its acronym HIMARS. These are far more sophisticated weapons, and for most of them, American manufacture has been at an all-time low. Production of Stingers, chiefly an anti-aircraft weapon, was off and on until 2023, when the manufacturer Raytheon called in retired engineers and production was fully resumed. Production of Tomahawks, the Navy's premier cruise missile, is anemic. When American ships began striking Houthi targets in Yemen in January, they fired more Tomahawks on the first day than were purchased in all of last year. The Navy has stockpiles, but clearly that rate of use is unsustainable. And missiles are far more complex than artillery rounds. They require a greater variety of scarce explosives as well as highly intricate electronics. While one howitzer round draws on about 50 different suppliers, a single missile depends on as many as 500 from dozens of countries. Imagine, as the Science Board did, that America was drawn unexpectedly into another significant war. If we are years behind meeting the demands of Ukraine, how would we fare if we had to provide naval support and ground troops to defend Taiwan? Or if a NATO country was invaded by Putin's Russia? Or if an expanding Middle East conflict draws the U.S. in more deeply? Worried about possible abandonment of Ukraine by Donald Trump, the Biden administration has stepped up deliveries of weapons and equipment, inevitably prompting concerns about the adequacy of our own stockpiles. America's lack of preparedness crept up on the country gradually. Ammo production reached a low after 2001 when the 9/11 attacks shifted the military's focus to Al-Qaeda and other non-state enemies. Arms manufacture had already slowed. Factories were closing. The brevity of the Gulf War in 1991, when Saddam Hussein's army was swept from Kuwait in 5 days, had reinforced a belief that stocking and maintaining prodigious supplies of weapons and ammunition was no longer needed. Even in the years of fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11, mostly involved intelligence, surveillance, and the small mobile infantry units of special forces. There was a brief upsurge in the production of heavily armored vehicles to counter mines and roadside bombs in Iraq, but even that long war did not halt the overall downward trend. An official Army history of the American weapons industry, completed in 2010, noted that, quote, the current industrial base is the smallest it has been, unquote, and it has continued to shrink. We'll be right back with more on the crumbling state of the U.S. military, but first, this is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the Donate button. All donations are tax-deductible. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Now back to our story about the crumbling state of the U.S. military. The hollowing out of America's arms manufacturing capacity is partly a granular story about factories and supply chains and the labor force. The size and complexity of the industrial base are important to understand, but the forces that shape manufacturing efforts in Iowa and Pennsylvania and elsewhere trace back to Washington, D.C. They involve politics, policy debates, military doctrine, expert predictions, taxpayer money, and ultimately the application of national will. The way we've envisaged and planned for future wars has led us down a dangerous path. There were always voices warning of the need to anticipate the possibility of a protracted ground war somewhere, and warning too of the strain that such a war would place on U.S. arms production. For example, in his 2020 book, The Kill Chain, Christian Brose, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, considered how a U.S. clash with China over Taiwan, called peer competitors fighting with most, if not all, of the same weapons, could easily erode into a brutal stalemate. Testifying before Congress in 2021, Admiral Philip Davidson, then the retiring head of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, cautioned that such a conflict could occur within the next 6 years, the so-called Davidson window. But U.S. military doctrine emphatically was not focused on fighting or supporting a major ground war, and the prospect of such a war in Europe in the 21st century seemed especially unlikely. So did the potential need for millions of conventional artillery rounds in an age of missiles. It would be as if, after World War II, there had been a sudden call for mounted cavalry. There was always some bit of a protracted conflict scenario, said Bill LaPlante, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, using strategic jargon for bloody fighting on a massive scale with no end in sight. But, he continued, the idea that we would be spending or sending to another country 2 million rounds of 155mm howitzer shells, I don't think we really thought through. And if someone had raised the possibility, the response would have been, I don't see that scenario. It is part of the Pentagon's job to imagine unlikely scenarios. War always upends expectations. Generals plot for surprise. And once wars begin, they evolve in unexpected ways, wrote Richard Danzig, a former Secretary of the Navy, in his influential 2011 monograph Driving in the Dark, quote, strategic judgments about future environments are often, one might say, predictably wrong, unquote. At the Ukraine war's outset, most analysts in the defense community believed that it would only last days or weeks. Russia would roll over its smaller neighbor, oust Zelensky, and install a compliant regime. Instead, the invasion triggered a valiant defense that rallied the Western world. 2 years later, the war has evolved into a stalemate, one that has been called World War I with technology. Ukraine's army has mounted an effective defense in part by the heavy use of artillery, especially howitzers. LaPlante described a recent tour of World War I battlefields and the immediate resonance he felt with the war in Ukraine, the men dug into trenches, the continual bombardment, and the relentless attrition. There had been an assumption, LaPlante said, that stealth and precision weaponry would somehow preclude this type of warfare, but it turns out it didn't. War planning occurs in a political and strategic context bigger than the Pentagon, which is another reason the U.S. finds itself where it is. Much of the reduction in America's arms manufacturing capacity was deliberate, a consequence of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. In 1993, the heads of some 24 of the military's biggest contractors were invited to a dinner at the Pentagon by then-Defense Secretary Les Aspin. As a representative from Wisconsin, Aspin had in 1990 led efforts in Congress to begin shrinking defense spending. The Berlin Wall had come down in 1989. The Soviet Union was fracturing. It was a heady time. The U.S. was no longer squared off against another superpower. Aspin had called for a new kind of defense, and no one was sure exactly what it would look like. Norm Augustine, then the CEO of Martin Marietta and a one-time undersecretary of the Army, was seated next to Aspin at the dinner table. He asked what was going on. Well, Aspin replied, in about 15 minutes you're going to find out, and you probably aren't going to like it. After the meal, the group was led to a briefing room where William Perry, Aspin's deputy, stood beside a screen and presented the plan, a dramatic reduction in defense spending. Perry explained that there were too many private contractors and the Pentagon could no longer afford them all. The fallout would be drastic, he said. Charts showed various categories of purchasing. In some, only one contractor would likely be left with enough business to survive. Augustine paid particular attention to the forecast for the aerospace industry. It showed that out of more than a dozen existing contractors in this field, perhaps only two or three would remain viable. He was stunned. For many of those in the room, it meant that their companies were doomed. They would either go out of business or be sold or absorbed by a competitor. Augustine came to refer to the meeting as the Last Supper. Perry, who would succeed his boss as defense secretary, was not wrong. Within a decade, the number of prime defense contractors, large companies that typically employ scores of subcontractors on big projects, fell from 51 to 5. In terms of personnel, the military shrank by 15%. The effect on defense manufacturing was drastic. According to Augustine, the aerospace industry alone lost 40% of its employees in the 1990s. Of course, Pentagon spending cuts were not the only factor. American manufacturing in general had been in a long decline as lower wages overseas and the effect of free trade agreements drained jobs away, but the impact of spending cuts was deep. For the past three decades, the U.S. war machine's private sector has been dominated by the Big Five, confirming a 1997 prediction by John Mintz of the Washington Post. Quote, by the end of his second term, it may emerge that President Clinton's most enduring legacy in national security will be his role in creating a handful of extraordinarily powerful defense contractors. Unquote. Fewer players meant less competition, and because the Big Five were so big, they undermined one of America's greatest strengths, its seemingly inexhaustible bounty of bright entrepreneurs with new ideas. The Big Five spent a lot on research and development and had the capacity to rapidly expand if a product took hold, but the galaxy of small entrepreneurial players was diminished. It became harder for startups to compete and thus to remain alive. Some held on by gaming the system. Bill Greenwalt, a defense analyst with AEI, explained that many companies became experts at just getting a couple million dollars doing a science project floated by the Pentagon, and then, when that speculative R&D project was done, raising their hand for another. They were accustomed to the concepts they developed going no further. If they did, the next step, turning the idea into a prototype, needed a steeper level of funding. If the concept cleared that hurdle, an even bigger one loomed, winning the funds to expand production. These obstacles became known as the Valley of Death because so many promising ideas and even proven prototypes died trying to make the leaps. The Big Five were better positioned to succeed than were smaller upstarts, and the Pentagon, like all large bureaucracies, is inherently cautious. Bigness meant being able to underwrite prototypes and expand production lines quickly. The upshot was both to curtail innovation and to deflect attention away from basic needs. One of the most famous examples of this dynamic was an unmanned aircraft invented by the Israeli aerospace engineer Abe Karem, originally called Albatross, then Amber, and finally the Nat 750. He won a Pentagon contract in the 1980s to design something better than the drone prototype offered by Lockheed Martin, known as Aquila. And he delivered, building a machine that cost far less, required just 3 operators instead of 30, and could stay aloft much longer than the Aquila could. Everyone was impressed, but his prototype vanished into the Valley of Death. Although it was a better drone, Aquila looked good enough, and Lockheed Martin was a familiar quantity. But Aquila didn't work out. Neither did alternatives, including the Condor from another of the Big Five, Boeing. Only after years of expensive trial and error was Karem's idea resurrected. It became the Predator, the first hugely successful military drone. By then, Karem's company had been absorbed into General Atomics, and Karem lost what would have been his biggest payday. Said Greenwalt, quote, "There are hundreds of Abe Karems out there in America today, and they get frustrated by the department. They move out to the commercial sector. Every one of those companies, I would argue, has probably got someone there who met the Valley of Death in DOD and is now doing something crazy in the commercial marketplace because that's where the money is," unquote. The flow of defense dollars to the Big Five didn't just stifle innovation. It also concentrated a growing share of available dollars into weapon systems of the costliest and least ordinary kind. If there is one major lesson to be drawn from the war in Ukraine, apart from the need for an ability to produce drones, munitions, and missiles fast, it's that small and cheap beats big and expensive, which is the opposite of the assumptions that underlie much of America's military spending. Drone warfare continues to teach that lesson. The Pentagon has launched expensive programs still unfolding to design and build small drone fleets. Meanwhile, Ukraine and Russia have both been using drones that can be bought off the shelf and adapted to military use, all for a tiny fraction of what the U.S. has spent. With its vibrant tech sector, Ukraine has excelled in configuring commercial drones for the rapidly changing conditions of the battlefield. For instance, the Ukrainians have recently made great strides in autonomous terminal guidance, that is, pre-programming drones with target information so that if the weapon encounters electronic jamming, it will remain on course. Stacy Pettyjohn, the director of the defense program at the Center for a New American Security, or CNAS, explained that the Pentagon has been working on this technology too, but with a project that has been years in development and has cost hundreds of millions of dollars. She said, quote, "The Ukrainians are doing it for a few thousand dollars in some guy's garage," unquote. The same cost disparity is evident in defending against drone attacks, what LaPlante has called the problem of our time. Patriot missiles, which cost $1 million apiece, were not intended for this. The Pentagon is pouring millions into developing countermeasures, but the answers are more likely to come from a tech startup, from someone like Abe Karem. Over the past half century, the Pentagon has become more of a buyer than an inventor, but it remains a notoriously deliberate customer. Acquisition procedures, legal requirements, and funding issues should slow to a crawl on the path from concept to production. As shocking as the Last Supper may have been to industry leaders, the larger policy impulse made sense, as much as a drawdown did when World War II ended. It was painful, but defense spending has always been a roller coaster. The problem was not the drawdown itself, but the structure left in place, heavily corporate in terms of major weapon systems, and yet astonishingly thin in terms of basic manufacturing. If some disaster, an accident, an attack, befell the Holston Army ammunition plant, the Army would quickly run out of bombs. All American aircraft carriers and submarines today are powered by small nuclear reactors. A single company makes them, BWX Technologies in Lynchburg, Virginia. Less money is only part of the issue. Congress controls the funding, and its dysfunction has had a profoundly negative effect on the military's manufacturing capacity. The decline of the American war machine reflects both corrosive partisanship and a loss of direction and will. Most of the defense budget, more than 80% of it, is essentially allocated before the generals even get their hands on it. The budget has, in effect, calcified. Its main expense categories have barely shifted in years. Personnel is the biggest fixed cost at about 40%. The million-person-plus military earns pay and benefits, health first among them. Keeping pace with inflation, those costs steadily grow. More money is spent on health care for military members and their families each year than is spent on building ships. And then there's a competition from private employers. Skilled welders, for instance, who have learned their craft in the Navy, can find ready employment in private shipyards when their tour of service ends for higher pay and greater benefits. Mackenzie Eaglin wrote in a 2022 AEI paper, quote, "Staying competitive with the private sector means the mandatory spending bills get larger every year, whether the overall budget grows or not," unquote. The Pentagon, she reported, quote, "spends almost $10 billion more on Medicare than on new tactical vehicles and more on environmental restoration and running schools than on microelectronics and space launches combined," unquote. The growth in personnel costs is so large that even when the Army has trimmed its ranks, the budget percentage has not gone down. Another large chunk of the budget goes to operations and maintenance, which also increases as equipment ages. Keeping aircraft, ships, tanks, and troop carriers combat ready is not optional. The relatively small piece of the Pentagon budget available for other kinds of spending, at most 15% and possibly half that, is still a lot of money, but competition for it is fierce. The manufacture of munitions, arguably the least sexy budget item, falls prey to the infighting. Would the Pentagon brass rather build a new generation of jets and ships and missiles, or instead notch up production of artillery shells that, under scenarios seen as likely, would never be used? Munitions have become known inside the Pentagon as a bill payer, something that can always be cut in order to make the budget balance. Meanwhile, timely, coherent federal budgeting is no more. Congress routinely fails to pass appropriations bills on schedule, resorting to continuing resolutions. This keeps defense dollars coming, but limits their use to existing projects. That would not be a problem if it happened only occasionally, but Congress has given the Defense Department a fully authorized budget, on time, only once in the past 15 years. This helter-skelter process constrains the Pentagon from adapting quickly to changing circumstances. New projects are put on hold, and there's no guarantee that money will eventually come. Private contractors need predictable dollar commitments to invest in new product lines, so they simply don't invest. As one senior Pentagon official described it, the phenomenon is an own goal that we do to ourselves every year. We'll get back to the final portion of our crumbling U.S. military right after this quick break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston, airing Thursdays at 6 p.m., Sundays at 1 p.m., and Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. We excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. And you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Thinkwing Radio with Mike Honig, and I'm on Threads and Blue Sky, and occasionally on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio. Now the conclusion of our story on the crumbling U.S. military. The U.S. today could not replicate the achievement of World War II. It could not build trucks and tanks and ships and airplanes in such volume. When the demand for conventional ammo soared in 2022, established players in private industry, skeptical that the war in Ukraine would last long enough to make investment profitable, were reluctant to gear up. Some smaller companies have been tempted to step in, but are also nervous about the risk. John Kaufman, who owns a small munitions company called Armada Ammunition based in Greensboro, Florida, is currently eyeing an opportunity to begin manufacturing howitzer ammo. He has hedge funds offering millions for him to begin making the rounds. He knows how to do it and even lined up suppliers for the raw materials. The demand is clearly there, for the moment, but what happens if it suddenly isn't? wars do end, or at least subside. Then, he says, you have all this machinery and all this product that you just ordered, and no guarantee that Washington will keep your company whole. Kaufman's situation is a microcosm of the one faced by any private manufacturer with military contracts. If Congress wanted to get serious about sustaining the military-industrial base, measures could be devised to give companies a cushion, basically a guarantee of security. Manufacturers nationwide faced the same dynamic during World War II, and the federal government stepped in and smothered the problem with dollars. Efficiency or penny-pinching was not as important as getting the job done. The problem today is not the scale of global war. The way Congress works today would not just cripple arms and ammunition supply in a global war, it would cripple it in war on any scale. John Quirk, a former Army officer who is now a senior staffer with the Senate Armed Services Committee, has been tracking the shortage of howitzer shells in particular. He said that the military has made some progress. Quote, what they have done, I would say, with large success in the Army and the acquisition community, is the work of a guy by the name of Doug Bush, unquote. Bush appears to be, in the words of one of his friends, the perfect nerd for the job. Slender, prim, graying hair, gone white, and at the temples, he is a bureaucrat's bureaucrat. He is also the official who made that own goal remark. Bush is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisitions, Logistics, and Technology. It's a mouthful of a title that is usually dispensed with in favor of the spoken acronym ASAALT, rhymes with basalt, an important but little-known position in the upper echelons of the Pentagon hierarchy. Bush is also the Army's science advisor and senior research and development official. The job is more than just building or buying what he is ordered to supply. It also means obtaining funding from Congress, which is hardly automatic. Bush knows the Army and he knows Congress. He became ASAALT 2 weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine. When war came, he and his team began asking the basic questions. How much ammo would Ukraine need? Of what we had, how much would we need to hold back? Could we make more? How fast? Could we keep up with the demand? The answer to every one of these questions was either, we don't know, or simply, no. Bush worked with Congress on special authorities for emergency contracts and helped persuade his old colleagues on Capitol Hill to pass, rapid fire, a series of supplemental funding bills. One of the biggest challenges was just finding enough explosives. We're going to use all the TNT capacity in the world we can get access to, Bush said this summer, but that addresses only short-term requirements. For the longer term, there needs to be major new energetics production, primarily of TNT and IMX, here in the United States, Bush said. Quote, so that's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investment that we are going to have to build out as fast as we can, unquote. In November, the Army awarded a contract to build a TNT plant in Kentucky. The U.S. has promised Ukraine more than 5 million artillery rounds, 500 million small-caliber ammo rounds, and much more. It has also committed billions of dollars to replenishing stockpiles for American forces. For all their accomplishments, what Bush and others have done is merely stabilize the patient in the ER. Systemic dysfunction remains. Bill LaPlante, looking at the future from a different angle than Bush does, sees even more to be concerned about. If the U.S. finds itself on a back foot when it comes to 19th and 20th century technology, how will it confront challenges that are even more sophisticated? In his role as Under Secretary of Defense, he is tasked with making the kinds of predictions he knows not to trust. How does a huge institution that spends billions and employs millions make sound plans if its assumptions are consistently wrong? How do you prepare to be unprepared? Today, the most obvious threat is high-volume fire, large numbers of small, cheap kamikaze drones attacking all at once, swarming and overwhelming defenses. This isn't some futuristic scenario. It's happening in Ukraine. Imagine if the Iranians or Houthis could send 300 drones and missiles against one or two American ships in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Department is at work on ways to defeat such attacks by means of AI-assisted targeting for rapid-fire weapons, for instance, or by directing a strong electromagnetic pulse to destroy the drone's robotic controls. Other potential threats include hypersonic missiles, electronic warfare, and cyber attacks, and these are only the threats that are known. Said LaPlante, quote, just get over the fact that you're not going to predict everything, unquote. Rather, he advised we need to plan for adaptability. LaPlante cited Danzig's Driving in the Dark as a blueprint. He said that its prescriptions for coping with uncertainty aren't guiding the Pentagon's thinking, at least for now. Metaphorically, Danzig's approach departs from the traditional fortress concept to embrace a more immunological strategy, more like the way the body defends itself against pathogens. New viruses appear, and the body adapts to counter them. Translating that into national defense means preparing to be surprised and prioritizing weapon systems that can, like antibodies, be altered and mass-produced swiftly. It means leaning on software, particularly AI, that can weigh alternatives and repurpose existing assets faster than people can. To counter the effects of the Last Supper, it means emphasizing shorter-term contracts with a more numerous variety of smaller companies, thereby encouraging both competition and innovation. It means adopting manufacturing methods that can be rapidly repurposed when the need for some product suddenly ends. All of this, taken together, would radically alter the Pentagon's status quo and redraw the military-industrial map. Doing so will not be easy. It will require extraordinary cooperation among Congress, the Pentagon, and the private sector. Said General Randy George, the Army's chief of staff and the person charged with making these decisions, when asked if the U.S. was truly capable of pursuing a new strategy and way of doing business, quote, "I think we could. I really do. I think it would be painful. People would feel it, but I am still a believer in American ingenuity," unquote. One experiment George mentioned is the Replicator Initiative, which is as much an innovation in process as it is in warfighting. It draws significantly upon what military experts have learned from Ukraine. As Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks explains, it will rapidly produce multiple thousands of autonomous systems, including relatively small and expensive drones. These will also have a modular structure capable of being adapted in the field to a variety of ends. Using existing and planned Pentagon funds, the project will rely on a number of small producers to achieve the volume needed. The idea is to enable a faster jump over the steepest obstacle in the Valley of Death, the one from proven prototype to mass production. Creating a more varied and competitive field of military contractors means investing in many that will fail, a high-risk game. Anyone who spends big on arms production needs predictable budgets and certainty of sales, so the Pentagon will have to shoulder some of that risk. And if the government is underwriting the effort, a lot will ride on who is leading the government. The current push will take a decade or more to become fully functional and will cost a lot more than even the generous sums Congress has been shelling out piecemeal over the past few years. The costs and risks of the directional plan defines will meet resistance. The Big Five are a powerful lobbying force and will have allies in Congress and possibly in the new administration, whose plans and ambitions and basic competence are question marks. As always, there will be a strong penchant to stick with the familiar. Even if the current experiments do morph into something permanent, they will represent a change in only one part of the procurement system. They will do nothing to address the fact that our national politics, which traditionally have united around issues of national defense, don't reliably do so any longer. They will not cure congressional dysfunction. They will not change our reliance on foreign supply chains. They will not obviate the need for environmental and safety regulations that add costs and that slow down manufacturing. They will not alter the fact that war always confounds expectations or that people will continue to balk at spending billions based on the proposition, what if? Absent a screaming national emergency, the U.S. has never been good at steering steadily in a clear strategic direction. The system for equipping the war machine is peacetime design, Douglas Bush explained. The basis of it is not built for war. One thing the U.S. should definitely do, he believes, is to stop thinking of America as the arsenal of democracy. Perhaps in theory we could go it alone, could press what's left of our manufacturing capacity to the single end of self-sufficient military production, but going it alone is not really an option. The task of supplying, running, and maintaining a modern war machine is beyond the capacity of any one nation. Starting from scratch and given 3 years to do it, the U.S. today could not replicate the achievement of World War II, could not build trucks and tanks and ships and airplanes in such volume. Bush suggested it might be better to start thinking about an arsenal of democracies, that is, multinational partnerships among the major democracies with America playing the major role. It would be maddening and messy and require immense energy devoted just to muddling through. Bush didn't mention the underlying premise. For the idea to work, we need to have democracies, and they need to stick together. A potential problem with an arsenal of democracies, I think, is that transporting parts and products requires control of land, sea, and air lanes. It creates another strategic vulnerability. The extent to which this could be done within the continental United States would be a strategic benefit and would also be good for the domestic economy by creating infrastructure and jobs. Regarding people balking at spending billions based on the proposition of what if, I have an answer to that. It's like buying insurance. It's either the stupidest thing you ever bought or the smartest thing you ever did, but only future you will know which. As for what it will mean depending on who is leading the government, 40 years ago, with Republicans running all the branches of government, getting these strategic goals met would have been the least of my concerns. But Trump's party is not the Republicans of 40 years ago. They're anti-vax, small government, anti-establishment extremists. Many of them want to metaphorically burn down our current government and institutions and make them something else. Many of them are Christian nationalist white supremacists, and they're anti-communist while not necessarily being anti-fascist. And this is a party that has not shown itself as being able to govern coherently or cohesively, and we may actually be grateful that that's the case. The war in Ukraine has opened a lot of eyes at the policy and think tank level, but will it have been in time? Our final story is from NPR.org. New leaders in Damascus call for cordial ties with a resistant Israel. The newly appointed governor of Damascus has called on the United States to use its influence to push for cordial relations with Israel. In a wide-ranging interview with NPR, Governor Maher Marwan, 42, said that Syria's new government did not want to see conflict with Israel, which has been striking strategic military installations in Syria since the regime of former President Bashar al-Assad fell earlier this month, or December. Marwan said, quote, "We have no fear towards Israel, and our problem is not with Israel. We don't want to meddle in anything that will threaten Israel's security or any other country's security," unquote. The governor said it was understandable that Israel was concerned when the new Syrian government took power because of certain factions. Marwan said, quote, "Israel may have felt fear at the beginning, so it advanced a little, bombed a little," unquote. In addition to Israel's strikes on military installation, it also has seized parts of the Golan Heights, stoking fears in Syria of annexation, and yet Marwan called Israel's fear natural. Israel and Syria have never had diplomatic ties. They share a border, but have been in a state of war since Israel's founding in 1948. The two nations have fought several wars over the decades, and travel between them has been forbidden. "This is good news. Very, very remarkable," said Uzi Rabi, a senior researcher at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern and African Studies at Tel Aviv University in Israel, said of Marwan's remarks to NPR. There is more to the story, and I will be including it in the text that I put out on my blog post. It's still early days, but it's all very interesting. I'm going to avoid using the word encouraging until we hear it in so many words from Syria's new leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa. And it's important to note that unless and until HTS and Ahmed al-Sharaa consolidate their power, any statements or promises they make to Israel and any other country is of limited value because there will always be the possibility of another change of regime. So we shouldn't get our hopes up too soon. Any serious and permanent change of the regional status quo, to the extent that anything in that part of the world is permanent, will take months and probably years, but change must begin somewhere. So keep your fingers crossed. That's all we have time for today. I hope you had and will have a happy new year. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville at 91.9 HD2. We are Houston's community media. I hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting, and I look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. You all take care.
Let's keep on looking for the light. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I heard the COVID-19 vaccine.
Do we really know about the long-term?
Did you read that thing on the internet about
that? There's a lot of talk about COVID-19 vaccines. Talk to your doctor or healthcare provider to make the decision that's right for you. Visit getvaccineanswers.org for more. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Are you a local musician, club owner, or in need of getting the word out about an upcoming live music show or event? If so, send us your information and we'll include it on KPFT's live music calendar. Americana, blues, country, rock, jazz, or zydeco, we include it all. Send us as much info as far in advance as possible and we'll make sure it's available to all of our listeners. We provide this 100% free music service in an effort to promote and support our vibrant live music community. And all it costs you is the time and effort to send it our way. So let us help you. All listings are one full week in advance, and submission deadline is 5 p.m. every Thursday. So please email your music calendar info to bluesound@kpft.org. And thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KPFT, Houston's community station.
Arnie here. Grab a pencil.
your checklist for 5 a.m. Turn off the alarm, pull the covers over your head, feed the baby, clock out of work, head to the drive-in for coffee and a breakfast burrito, and turn on KPFT. The Attitude with Arnie Arneson is back. Radio that delivers life through the lens of politics and policy. But the operative word is life.
Tune into the